Consequence Podcast Network.
Welcome to Consequence Uncut, a series that gives listeners and readers a deeper dive into our features with major artists.
For our very first episode, we couldn't have asked for a better subject than Josh Homme of Queens of the Stone Age.
Johnny Cash had a great quote, "I'm not the creator of the music, I'm the deliverer." And I love that because it suggests a very servile attitude. You're blessed to have this job and you do everything you can to ferry the music across the river to the other side and bring it into being.
So, who the hell are we and why are we here? I'm Mijon Zulu. I'm the lead producer of Consequence Podcast.
I am Paolo Ragusa. I am an associate editor at Consequence.
Amazing. I love your last name, by the way.
Thank you. It's Italian.
I know. I always wanted to go with like Ragusa or something like that.
You have to say it, yeah, with a little bit of drama.
I know. But I'm so excited to share this interview because I so enjoyed listening to your conversation.
Absolutely. Josh really immediately sort of went into the deep end with me. As soon as we began, even before I started recording, we recorded this over Zoom. And a few days before the interview, I had given myself a black eye on accident, slipped and fell in the middle of the night, hit my head. It was all sorts of black under my eye. So I was a little nervous. But, you know, usually for Zoom interviews, the artist will keep their camera off because they want to be in their own space.
Yeah.
But of course, right when we joined, Josh had his camera on and immediately asked, "Oh, can I see you? Can you turn your camera on?" And of course I did. And I was like, "By the way," gave myself this terrible black eye. And we ended up joking about it. But yeah, it was a great little precursor to the conversation because pretty instantly he talked about the sort of vulnerable approach of creating this album. And he was very eager to connect with me and really share his thoughts and his philosophy on making music. What I really appreciated is there's a very little hesitation for him to jump in the deep end and really talk about what this new album in Times New Roman means to him. He goes really in depth about a lot of the personal strife he was experiencing, a lot of the adversity he was experiencing when the band was recording this album. He produced it all by himself alongside the band, and it definitely is one of the darker, more tortured Queens of the Stone Age albums to date.
I know, and like, I didn't expect him to be so vulnerable and so committed to sharing honest bits of himself. Like when he even said that he wrote the music like years before and then he couldn't get himself into the right emotional space to actually sing and create the words around it. I was moved.
Absolutely. Me too. I think throughout the conversation, you'll get not just inside looks into each of these songs and what they mean, but you'll also get a lot of his personal philosophy about making music, especially considering this is the 8th Queens of the Stone Age album. So he's been at this for a long time, him and the band. And it's really great to hear that, you know, after all of this time, he's still really engaged and jumping into this process and really open and vulnerable with how the process was.
I know. And it just shows like how much more meaningful the music that Queens of the Stone Age makes and that this songwriting process creates.
Absolutely. So you can check out the article on consequence.net entitled "Queens of the Stone Age's Josh Homme is Addicted to Risking It All." And please subscribe to the podcast feed to stay up to date with these in-depth interviews.
And with that, we'll turn it over to Paolo and Josh. Please enjoy.
I got to spend some time with the new album, Times New Roman. It's coming out this week, 6 years after the last Queens of the Stone Age album. So first things first, how is it feeling? What's going through your mind? What are you thinking about this week?
In particular, because this was finished, sort of Mikey Shoes and Mark Rankin and I finished this almost like by candlelight in the dark and worked so hard. It's like a wedding cake where you're like putting that butterfly that circles around it and you back away from it like this. It was a difficult record to make. And so I just feel like I was talking with Mike about it. I forgot. He did the same. He forgot to create an expectation. The making of it. And when you're done, you're like, "Oh, fuck." And you kind of breathe a sigh of relief. And so it's kind of nice to have neglected to create some kind of perception about the fact that it will be received and what that will be.
How long was the sort of gestation period of this album? When did it begin?
The music was recorded about 2.5 years ago.
Ah, okay.
You know, but I didn't sing it or I didn't have the words really, until November of last year. So I think it's one of those things where, I don't know, the words are really important to me. And so I think I kept writing too close to what was happening for me. And I needed to get about 20 feet back from it. It's a better spot, you know.
I see. So. Yeah, have a little bit of that vantage point. Well, speaking of those, I just kind of want to dig into the album. But first, I do want to start with the title. I noticed, obviously, it's a line in the last song, Straight Jacket Fitting. Why do you feel that that title sums up the album in Times New Roman?
Well, for a start, it's just a little bit funny.
Yeah.
This feeling inside. I'm not one of those who can easily hide. Mm-hmm. You know, some records are made ahead of their time or behind their time, and some are made that feels like they're of their time. And I don't think you really get a choice on that, because by the time you're done and it comes out, is it still of its moment? You know, I think if I do have one sort of perspective, my expectation is that I think this record is actually of its time. It's not negative to say Rome is burning and the Titanic is sinking. I don't think at all. I think it's, this record is very much about acceptance. And to accept something, you need to identify it for what it really is, and not be, you need to admit the reality of the situation you're in, you know? And maybe that's why it took so long for me to get the words right, you know? So I just think, yeah, in Times New Roman, hell, it's just funny too.
Absolutely. I definitely get that. I'm after spending some time with this album, I do kind of see a little bit of that paranoia and that sort of acknowledgement of Rome is burning. Talk about the first two singles, Emotion Sickness and Carnivore. First things first, you know, what made you decide on those two albums to be the first slices of In Times New Roman?
Well, we don't sort of consider the conventional singles to radio anymore. And so I think it's really more about creating an impression on the first listen of something. You know, it's like, what do you want to say first? You know, we've never had a Crosby, Stills, and Nash three-part harmony thing going before. So,
yes.
and I think Emotion Sickness is just a strange little Frankenstein's monster. It seems sort of sewn together, parts from disparate regions sewn together. But I also think that is a good mantra for the record, is picking up your pieces and sewing yourself back together. It has that right emotional tonality. And Carnivore is another one where it's, I think it shows the kind of musical tightrope walking that's happening on this record. There's a lot of dynamic shifts going on. This record is tonally very brutal, mm-hmm. guitar-wise, and it almost seems unfinished in a way, perhaps, you know, because it's so raw. There's things out of tune, there's things out of time, there's mistakes everywhere. And when the orchestration and things like that come in, what they do is they sort of offset that brutality for a minute with something fragile.
I think that's a beautiful way of putting it. I like that you noted Crosby, Stills, and Nash for that Emotion Sickness, because I was getting Steely Dan in that last, those mini sections.
I'll take that too.
As long as we're almost there.
As long as it's not Crosby, Stills, and Nash Bridges. I just think that's not very good.
I see. Kind of going in the other direction, one of my favorite songs on this album was Paper Machete, a very vintage Queens of the Stone Age song. I just want to hear about that song, how it came together, and maybe where that represents the album, especially coming second in the track list.
You know, it's fun to put something together. It's fun to, each song is its own little arc of a story, and then they're there to snap into the puzzle. They're each puzzle pieces that snap into each other to support a grander arc. And hopefully, the album snaps into, it's part of a grander puzzle as well, you know? And so I think Paper Machete is almost a way of saying, it's going to be all right. There's some classic us here, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, and I think it's actually a really good example of how each member of this band really is themselves articulated on this, like that lead line that's going through the song. That's such quintessential Dean, you know, it's very him, the style and the way it's played. And Troy was saying, I'm going to do a lead that's the exact tone as Little Sister. It will almost be like, I guess we call them cousins, like Little Sister has as much, is related to Paper Machete and somehow is related to our first song, Regular John, all the way back. It's like, I also think lyrically, this has become this diary of a life. You know, you're writing, soundtracking your life. And so it's like when you stop the film and pull a single frame, each song is like a single frame of an emotion. And certainly this one kind of represents the frustration of saying, I've had enough. No, now I've had enough. And I think that's important to be able to kind of really distill it down to one drop of an emotion for each song, you know?
I love that. Yeah. A beautiful little snapshot of that kind of feeling. I think that's wonderful. I'd love to hear just about the recording experience. Obviously, the last record was done by Mark Ronson, and, you know, you've kind of been back at the helm for this one. So did it feel a little bit like going back to the basics production wise, or what was the experience, especially doing this in your studio as well as Rick Rubin's studio? What was the kind of that 2-year process?
You know, it was really lovely to work with Mark. And I think, you know, it's about Ronson, this strange chemistry, something that reads strange on paper, is something I've always loved. And I think it creates a talking point all on its own. But this time around, I knew how raw I wanted to make it.
Yeah.
The words are one thing, you know, you're trying to write as close to, try to write in that third truth, like there's yours, mine, and what actually happened. And yeah. I feel that's really important. But words also fail sometimes. And I think it's easier for me to play how I feel than say how I feel a lot of the time. And so knowing that the desire was to make the record so raw and brutal, just sonically brutal, and that the dynamic would be so large that it would be hard to ask a producer to take that risk, or it might actually water it down, than just doing it yourself and saying, this record, it will take the dynamic, you know, at the end of Carnivore, your dynamic is as loud as it can possibly be without destroying or going to digital static. You know, if you were to ask someone to do that for you, they would be like, no. So I think it's best to be very Dr. Jekyll. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he tried all his serums on himself first, right? So Mr. Hyde came to be. And I think, you know, this is definitely me saying, I'll take the risk so I don't have to ask someone else to shoot themselves in the foot, you know?
Wonderfully put. And then also kind of along those lines, I just kind of, you know, I feel like this album, we get a few more sides of your vocals that we maybe haven't gotten before. And especially, you know, considering the subject matter in these lyrics and how personal this has been for you, this whole process, have you encountered a lot of challenges vocally that have really pushed you, or, you know, how do you feel like your profile as a vocalist in this band has sort of changed with this album?
This should be a high risk business. You know, you're supposed to, sometimes I worry that it's like risking it all is like, I'm too addicted to that. I want to say things that are hard to say. Trust me, it's hard to sing voyeurism jism, right? It's hard to, like some things are just hard to say, right? And so there's that aspect where you're like, how do I sing something like that, right? How do I sing something that feels almost like the first time you sing it, you're embarrassed. Mm-hmm. Can I do this? And then also we have been blessed to have people like Mark Lanegan and Nick Oliveri and just kind of on and on that really sing and have such an individual voice. I think in those moments, I really didn't need to pursue any directions where they existed, because it is such a wonderful job of covering that over there, the Lanegan way. But as the years have gone on now, I just want to do things that I haven't done. There's less moments of the paper machetes, which are sort of retaining a sense of self. And there's more moments of taking a risk and expanding on what you do. There was a lot of talk between us where I was just like, if we've done it, I don't want to do it again. I don't want to do what we've done already, unless it's the absolute best version or representation of that. And there's a lot of challenging vocals on this record that are just hard to sing, kind of, you know? And so I think that's more rewarding, because I feel like when the risk is there, I'm more excited.
Yeah, definitely. I also kind of like what you said, especially you're bringing up that line, voyeurism, jism. There's a lot of lines kind of sprawled throughout this album of, you know, it's almost like a blink, if you blink and you miss it.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting because you do kind of add this level of drama to some of those lyrics, and like you feel a little bit of that character kind of edging up against, you know, this sort of reflection of who you are. And I think that that's a really interesting kind of new look for this Queens of the Stone Age album.
I think you just said something important. That's a character. Like, I'm so obsessed with wanting it to feel real, which is a really vague statement. It's like, so how does that work? How does it become real? And for me, it's, you know, doing things that are, frankly, are terrifying or scary or embarrassing or difficult to admit, right? Because then I know it's honest and it's vulnerable. And in order to deliver something properly and really give every song is its own personality, and to get the personality of that song right, you find yourself like this. There's a, in this tune, What the People Say, but there's a background that I was like, oh God, this is going to be really embarrassing, you know? And Mike is saying, what? And it's like, I have to go.
This episode is brought to you by Mubi, a curated streaming service dedicated to elevating great cinema from around the globe. From iconic directors to emerging auteurs, there was always something new to discover. With Mubi, each and every film is hand-selected, so you can explore the best of cinema, streaming anytime, anywhere. Like Pavements, Alex Ross Perry's rockumentary biopic hybrid about the only band that matters, Pavement. Starring members of the band, as well as Joe Keery, Jason Schwartzman, and Tim Heidecker, the wildly original picture tackles the mythology of the band, their anticipated comeback, and more in a fashion that matches their left-field ethos. To stream Pavements and other great films, you can try Mubi free for 30 days at mubi.com/COS. That's mubi.com/COS for a month of great cinema for free.
Like, I have to do it like a, because I hear it. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately for me, I'm slave to what I hear. So I have to sing it in a way like a big dumb brute. And it's embarrassing to go, and it can't be over articulated in order to work properly. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, and if it doesn't work, I'm just going to need to take five and be like, oh my God, what are you doing right now, man? But it works and it adds to the personality. It's like decorating a fucking Christmas tree or something. It's like it's the grand total is made of these tiny details and they're amalgamed together. So you have to take chances like that. And that may seem like a nominal chance to take, but they're still necessary little leaps to make. Yeah,
absolutely. And many of them really add up, I think. You know, I also just really appreciate that, you know, you're so many years in now to your career and you're still, you want to kind of go there and take those risks and be a little bit silly. And like, that's so important, I feel like, especially in 2023 in rock music. And, you know, not everybody has the courageousness to be silly. I think that that's very important.
Well, I think, you know, I don't take myself that serious. So I don't really, you know, I think it needs to be vulnerable is mandatory. It's the minimum obligation. Mm-hmm. And it's taken all these years to get to this point where it's just jungle and a machete and there's no one else and you're really trying to carve your own road. I mean, I guess we play rock music, I guess.
More
it's
or less.
Just, it, you know, but yeah, we use guitars, keyboards and drums and bass. It's like we use these tools, but you're trying to create an emotion and it takes all these things to do it. And, you know, it would be silly for me not to reject feeling silly while doing some of these things, you know, because it has to get there for real. And it's worth trying and failing. I think that the failing is what's so important. Yeah, you know?
Absolutely. I kind of want to go back to what you said about just a lot of this album being about acceptance. And I really, you know, now that I've kind of listened, especially the final outro of Straight Jacket Fitting, that sort of acoustic, very idyllic outro, would you say that that sort of represents a little bit of that acceptance that you were kind of speaking about earlier?
Absolutely. I think, I also think, I mean, it's the first song of Scenery played acoustically. And so there's a bit of a full circle. And I love suggesting the future. I love playing that game with our fans and people that I realize that many people listen to music on the way to the bank and then they don't think much of it. And that's fine. I'm okay with that. But if you listen deeper and more times and you get into it, I think that's where the band for you, because, you know, it's even like in Times New Roman, the villains come like clockwork. That simple fact should be enough for people to try to start the Wizard of Oz at the front of one of these records. And I love poking, prodding, pushing, pulling. And, you know, why can't you play a dirty trick lovingly on your fans and on your friends. It's like, you know, so I doubt highly the acoustic thing is a dirty little trick, but it's just one of many. You think about a song and give it its due, then you try to make this record, and then you try to connect that puzzle piece to the rest of your career too. Mm-hmm. And I think I do that because I really don't have any hobbies. So I have nothing else to do, you know, think of this shit.
Well, that's good. Spoken like a true artist. So I have a bit of a more abstract question as we've been talking about this album, and you kind of brought up, you know, the fans and what maybe the fans are expecting. But I just, you know, from a very abstract place, who is this Queens of the Stone Age album for?
I think it's a great question. Actually, I'm glad to get a question like that doing this part of being a band. I think that, you know, I try to make something I really love, and the guys I know do the same. It's, you try to make something you really love, and that, and you really give yourself to this thing, because I think it can make you a better person if you give everything you have to this artistic process of making a record. And it can unload baggage, it can help you to overcome great obstacles, and you're making your very best attempt to express how you feel, especially in times that are dark, and to appreciate the time and moments of hallelujah in between the darkness, right? So I think, who is it for? It's for other people that have survived difficulties or are in the midst of a difficulty that's overwhelming. And if I really love it, I can attract someone who's looking to really love something, like minds, and I'm trying to manifest this belief. It's almost like religion at some point, you know, because Johnny Cash had a great quote, "I'm not the creator of the music, I'm the deliverer." And I love that because it suggests a very servile attitude. You're blessed to have this job, and you do everything you can to ferry the music across the river to the other side and bring it into being. So I think this record is for people that either have survived that difficult time or are in the midst of it.
Absolutely. Beautifully put. I definitely am getting that sort of giving nature, I think, in this album, especially in that ending section and the sort of acceptance there. So kind of moving in a different lens, this is another difficult question, but maybe won't be as hard. What is your favorite riff on this album?
I think I actually like Made to Parade. I think I love the end of that song the most. Mm-hmm. That's my, you know, you play with song arrangements and things like that. And Made to Parade feels like classic Queens, but yet we haven't ever heard anything like that from us. It's very kind of quintessentially Queens riff, a stupid boneheaded thing, right? And then it goes, instead of going, it goes to a chorus that's very small, you go back to the verse, and then you go to a, instead of going back to the same chorus, it's three different choruses each time. It's just, and they keep getting bigger until the end. That end just, like, before anything was sung on it, there was the lead and this, the way it sounded. And it always just made me feel good when I got there. It's weird how listening to something can make you feel good. I always found that so fascinating. The music's such a crazy elixir. It's that it actually can do things to your mind and your emotions and get your juices flowing. It's weird that actually works.
Yeah.
It's strange that you can play music that's terrifying too. That's scary. It's funny that, you know, you can cobble these things together that actually triggers an emotional response. It's just weird. It's one of the weird things of how magical life is.
I like that you brought up that song too. I do really feel like, you know, in the end, you kind of, it's like you crack open into another universe almost and just let it ride. I just think it's so beautiful. Well,
I think it's funny how if you're being servant, like being a servant to the music, you know, at the end, I have to say something that matches that emotional tonality. Mm-hmm. And so it's funny how it just sort of guides you and you get to go, oh, okay, I know what I'm supposed to accomplish here. Mm-hmm. And I'm always really pleased with moments like that where the music is your guide. Let the music be your guide, where I'm listening to what it tells me to do. Mm-hmm. If that feels nice to, because it's like, oh, I'm not driving. I'm sitting shotgun here. And that's just cool because it's, again, it's just weird that you would be able to turn over the controls to this thing.
Yeah. I think that's wonderful. Kind of going into that a little bit, you know, you guys just finished your first two shows a couple weeks ago. First shows back in a few years. What was that like, especially getting back in a festival? You know, have you noticed any changes in festivals, obviously, since the pandemic? Yeah, what was that experience like, Sonic Temple and Boston Calling?
Well, you know, I wasn't interested in playing in my living room online because, and many people did that. And I thought, well, okay, well, there's enough of that. That's not a requirement. No one's requiring me to show up in this way because I liked the drama and the effort and the wildness and the atmosphere when it's firing on all cylinders and we're doing something, man, you know? So I guess I just felt really appreciative. In particular in Boston and in Ohio, I guess I was a little scared maybe, but it went really well and it was fun, which is perhaps sometimes feels like a goofy word to say, and especially with like playing live, like, boy, gee, that was fun. But what can I say? That's in Boston, the moon was high, mm-hmm. The temperature was perfect. The crowd was smiling and dancing. Much like Ohio, it kept getting more and more and more wild as it went, which is all I really want is for people to, I think when people are being themselves, they go wild. Mm-hmm. So I associate this group wildness with people being themselves. And I, you know, maybe the hallmark of us is that we don't tell you what to do. You know what I mean? In a world that is constantly selling you something and selling you fear and telling you what you can't do and making all these rules, I always pride myself on being like, hey, do whatever the fuck you want. You just don't hurt each other. We're good. So it was nice.
Nice. You know, you talking about that reminds me, I saw you guys, the only time I've gotten to see Queens of the Stone Age, it won't be the last, but I saw you guys at Coachella in 2014 on that first weekend. And to this day, that is still the loudest show I have ever seen. I had to tell you.
I think that loud is important too. You know, they play a lot of these, and they're like, hey, you know, you're going to hurt somebody. And I just, everyone trying to protect everyone is really, safety is only what you were. It's not what you are. Safety is fucking illusion that people try to sell you so you'll calm the fuck down. But there is no such thing. It's a past tense word. You don't think anything's going to happen to you now, but that's not really the case. That's not how life is.
Yeah.
You know, safety is just what we were 5 seconds ago. We made it safely through that. But as we live and breathe and move forward, the present tense is never fucking safe. And I kind of am annoyed by people's attempt to sell safety everywhere as if it were a lollipop you want to lick. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Loud is good.
Yeah. That show was really good. And it was also super windy. I remember it definitely worked with the environment. It was very memorable.
Yeah. I mean, it is very much a consequence of sound.
Yeah. Exactly. So we have only a few minutes left. There's actually an initiative that we are doing at Consequence called Consequence Hometowns, where we are really celebrating local venues. If you have a favorite local venue under 2,000 capacity, which is that venue and why?
Well, I like the Terragram. I think it's all the sight lines are good. It's easy to be there. Yeah. I think the Troubadour is a beautiful little place too. Mm-hmm. And that has been played host to so much that you just can't believe it. And I think it should be recognized as like a landmark, you know? And, you know, I still love the desert. Like Pappy and Harriet's is a wonderful place to go because it's authentic American roadhouse. And I guess being kicked out of there as a teenager with a fake ID many times, like I just, it's hard to not like being allowed in and being thrown out. You know?
Absolutely. I mean, I guess, you know, you can continue with Pappy and Harriet's here, but have either of these venues had a specific impact on your career or your development as an artist?
Well, the Troubadour particularly has. It was the place where we started really cutting our teeth. Mm-hmm. And it felt so good. You know, it's funny to hear you're sold out. It doesn't matter if the venue's small or big. It's just you're like sold out the Troubadour and you're like, fuck yeah. I just think when it's small like that, it's easier to sell out, but yeah. It sure does feel good. And some of my first real sellout experiences were there. So
amazing. What would you say to encourage fans to go see a show or musicians to play a gig there or at Terragram or at Pappy and Harriet's?
Well, I think they all share the same thing, which is you spill out over each other.
Yeah.
You know, you're at point blank range, and you can see people step on pedals, or you can hear them breathe in between songs, and so I think, you know, you become part of the pulsating rhythm of being there. It's like one organism a bit.
That reminds me of seeing a show at the Roxy. I haven't been there in years, but you could see everything at that venue. Yeah,
right. And the Roxy is interesting because for some reason, whenever I'm watching something there, it always like looks like it's on TV somehow. It's like, it's got a TV just how quality. Wide. Yeah. And like, you're so just there. A lot of these little venues are so wonderful, and I'm glad they survived. Because people seem to not, all of a sudden, it seemed to be the last thing people cared about helping.
What would you like to say in appreciation to the people who are behind the scenes and working at these venues?
Well, I think if you really sit down and imagine what it's like to work at a venue and have music, loud music every night, and what it takes to support that underground culture, it takes a lot of effort and you have to really care about it. And so you're talking about people that are dedicating their lives to supporting things as they're getting started in this infant stage of development, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, and so I couldn't be more appreciative of places like that. I mean, I wouldn't be anywhere without them. And frankly, it's a major commitment by anyone to just be part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're a fucking bartender, it's like you're a bartender at a place where the music is pounding. And you're hearing shit and amazing music and like it's just the constant melding of these wonderful attempts to do something different.
Beautiful. Perfectly put.